the righteousness of God revealed. We now ask our brother John to come forward and lead us in this subject.
Brethren and sisters and dear young people, not quite sure what the presider meant when he welcomed me to the meeting tonight, whether it was the fact that I had been away for a couple of weeks or not, but perhaps it does give me the opportunity to introduce my remarks with something which over the last two or three weeks I have found personally very helpful. I was over in New Zealand 2 weeks ago tonight in the midst of a study on Romans. And on that occasion, we covered 8 chapters of Romans in 8 sessions. To say that I was a little apprehensive about how that would go would be the greatest understatement I've made in a long time. I was very, very apprehensive about the possibility of covering 8 chapters of Romans in 8 nights. Obviously, one couldn't hope to attempt to go into any depth, but at the same time hope to perhaps cover the general theme of those chapters. We'll have a look in just a moment at the breakdown of Romans again, and we'll see how the first 8 chapters are quite an important entity in themselves. I must say, however, I found it particularly beneficial because I did find that for myself it brought a lot of the themes very much into focus. That whilst there were themes in their own right, which I can see quite clearly, to actually do a concentrated study of 8 chapters and actually have to talk to them is much different from sitting down and listening to somebody else talk about them or even sitting down at your desk and studying them. And the concentration on that I found particularly helpful. The other thing I also found very encouraging was that we got quite a bit of discussion from the people there, but the ecclesia was made up of a large quantity of people who have been just recently baptised and some who are approaching baptism. In fact, one young man was baptised on the second Sunday. And they were saying how very helpful Romans had been to them in their understanding. I thought this was good from the point of view that Romans is often regarded as a difficult book. We may recall Brother Carter's opening comment in his book. In fact, the very opening statement is that many people would say that Romans is the most profound book in the whole world. The conclusion that I have come to, and I think it's a right one, is this. That what the Apostle Paul is actually saying in Romans is not difficult. The points that he's making are really very, very basic. What does at times appear to make the book profound is the argumentation that he uses to prove his point. And the reason for that is that on many occasions he is addressing Jewish people. And these Jews had a particularly, in fact, a peculiar way of viewing not only the law and not only the truth, but life in itself. And we saw that, if you can think back far enough, at our last class, where the apostle put up 4 hypothetical questions that a typical Jew would ask. And really, he reasons with them according to their own reasoning. So if Romans at times appears to be difficult, don't ever get the idea that the doctrines that are being propounded are difficult or that the conclusions are difficult. In fact, we found them to be particularly exhortational. And so in the course of 8 studies, where it was condensed into a very short period of time, it was possible to keep the continuity of the argument flowing in a way which is sometimes difficult when there are 2 weeks between classes, or sometimes worse than that if the speaker doesn't happen to be here. So what I do intend to do tonight, and I will do it regularly without any further apologies, is to continually keep going back and just reviewing the argument. This in no way is intended to override the resumes, because the resumes are very much a specific resume of the previous class. But what I will keep doing is going back and just picking up that argument from the start. And when we've got that, and particularly as we see we are coming now to a new section tonight, we do find that having got the basis of the argument, then of course the exhortation becomes very, very powerful and very beautiful indeed. There is a breakdown of the book, which comes in the form of a Bible insert, of which that is one half of it. And I think most have a copy of that particular Bible insert.
Not tonight,
no. No, it went out on an earlier night. One of the first nights. There's a Bible insert.
We haven't got any notes for
tonight. No notes tonight. Anyone else missing notes for tonight? Put your hand up if you are missing notes for tonight. There's a couple down the front here didn't get tonight's notes. David's getting those. If you happen to have the Bible insert, which is the breakdown of the book, don't know that I've... Well, you know what it looks like. That looks like one half of it. If you can put the other half on the other side, that's what it looks like. And Heather over here. Anybody else not get tonight's notes? And over this side too. Thanks, David. And while you're walking around, you also have some pass notes if anybody wants them after the class. Right, so anybody who is missing any pass sets, David also has some of those left. Well, as we are just glancing at the breakdown which we see set before us on the screen, when we look at breakdowns of books, we often think, well, that's the opinion of that particular person. But in fact, the breakdown of Romans which we see before us would be a very generally accepted one, because Romans does fall very logically into these elements. And what we will notice is that in the course of our study so far, we have actually come down to the end of this particular section here, which in the running down this particular one is called 3a. Now let's see if we can just recall the argument that the Apostle Paul has presented to us so far in developing this argument. Rather than just look up the scriptures themselves, we'll just have a quick glance at the pages as they would appear if we happen to be using an Oxford Bible. We will recall that the Apostle Paul introduced himself in quite extensive terms in Romans. And he took about 7 or 8 verses just to introduce himself. We saw how that this was by far the most extensive of any of the letters that the Apostle Paul wrote. Just the terms that he uses. Paul, a servant of Jesus Christ, called to be an apostle, separated under the gospel of God, which he had promised afore by his prophets in the Holy Scriptures, concerning his son Jesus Christ our Lord, which was made of the seed of David according to the flesh, and declared to be the Son of God with power, according to the Spirit of holiness by the resurrection from the dead, by whom we have received grace and apostleship for obedience to the faith among all nations for his name, among whom are ye also the called of Jesus Christ. And that in fact is his introduction, and then he gets on to the greeting. And when we saw the extent of the actual introduction, and as we saw that in any of the epistles we studied, really when one gets to the end of the epistle, it's necessary to go back again and say, well, let's read that introduction again. Because in fact, the whole message of the epistle is found in the introduction. So we did consider in some detail that introduction, but realising that we would have to keep coming back to it as we progress through our studies. In the course of his greeting, he pointed out that the Roman Ecclesia had a very good reputation. He hadn't met them, but he said that he was looking forward to being mutually upbuilt. He says, that is, verse 12, that I might be comforted together with you by the mutual faith both of you and me. It didn't appear as though there was any particular problem extant at that time in the Roman Ecclesia that necessitated this particular letter. But it appears that the Apostle Paul took the opportunity of putting down in writing the conclusions that he had reached as a result of travelling through a large part of the Roman world, establishing ecclesias, and finding the problems that seemed to arise in most places. Those problems came as a result of the Gentile mind and the Jewish mind. These minds often came into conflict in the ecclesia itself. And so he was going to explain what he concluded was the end result of Gentile thinking left to itself and the end result of Jewish thinking left to itself. In these early chapters, that's what he does. And so it is then that he establishes the premise of what he is going to deal with in the letter. And we can say without any doubt that Romans 1 verses 16 and 17 become perhaps the key verses in the whole book in regard to what the theme of the book is going to be all about. Those two verses read this way. For I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Christ. It is the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believeth, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For therein is the righteousness of God revealed from faith to faith, as it is written in the book of Habakkuk, the just shall live by faith. Now this book is not just going to become a theoretical exposition on the subject of the righteousness of God. Undoubtedly, he will lay the basis in the early chapters. Tonight we're going to move into a new phase of considering the subject of the righteousness of God. But what he does then in the course of his argument is that from verse 18 of the chapter, that's chapter 1, through to the end, he points out how that God's wrath has been rightly poured out upon the Gentiles. He points out how that God had given them up because of their frame of mind. Remember what he says in verse 18. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold, that is, hold down or suppress the truth in unrighteousness. And you see, that verse was set in contrast to verse 17, which had said, for therein is the righteousness of God revealed. So the righteousness of God had been revealed in the gospel, but the Gentile mind at large said, I don't want it. I'm going to suppress the truth. And the truth that they were suppressing was not so much the truth of the gospel as we actually refer to it, but as he goes on to say in verses 19 and 20, which you'll note from the colouring here in the margin, verses 19 and 20 become an explanation of verse 18, that the truth that they were suppressing was even the truth that there was in fact a God, and that God demanded of them a certain way of life. Because it says in verses 19 and 20, because that which may be known of God is manifest in them, for God hath showed it unto them. For the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. His argument is simply this, that all they have to do is to look at nature, and they can see by the very orderliness of nature, by the very way in which God had established nature, that there has to be a supreme power. Therefore, there is no excuse. They are absolutely without excuse for the way in which they are living. And that would be the same thing that he would say about the world today. The world out there is getting worse by the second, but they are without excuse. There is no excuse for a person to say there isn't a divine creator. They may not know the gospel, but that is not particularly what Paul is talking about in those verses. Because in verse 21 then, through to the end of that chapter, he then illustrates the way of life that the Gentiles were leading. And he says there is no excuse for that way of life. God, however, gave them up to the depravity of their mind. And so then, he concludes in verse 32 by completing the sentence which was actually started back in verse 18. And that says, who, knowing the judgment of God, that they which commit such things are worthy of death, not only do the same, but have pleasure in them that do them. So under the general heading then, coming back to our breakdown, under the general heading then, of the doctrine of the righteousness of faith demonstrated, we came then to this section 3a, which was man's failure to attain to righteousness. So in that latter part of chapter 1, that is verses 18 to 32, Paul has demonstrated how that the Gentiles had failed to attain unto righteousness. The Gentiles had failed. We come then to chapter 2. In chapter 2, he now directs his attention to the Jews. And the Jews saw themselves as somewhat different. Well, they were different. God had constituted them something different. But the apostle points out to them that as far as God's wrath was concerned, God's wrath would be poured out just as much on Jews as it would on Gentiles. What were the Jews doing? They were boasting in the fact that they had received the law. We are Jews. Look, we have been circumcised. And so because they had received the law, because they had received circumcision, they automatically thought that made them better. And Paul says, no, it doesn't automatically make you better at all. The first thing, however, that it does for you is it gives you a greater responsibility. The greater the privilege, and you are privileged to be a Jew, the greater the responsibility. And that's a chapter which could well come down to the Christadelphian who says, look, I know the truth. We often talk about the Gentiles outside, much as the Jew might talk about it. We have been baptized. Well, that only means that we have a greater responsibility. It doesn't mean that we are automatically better because of something which we have been privileged to receive. And therefore, in Romans chapter 2, the Apostle Paul points out to them that whilst the Jews were condemning Gentiles, they were doing exactly the same things themselves. So consequently, then, in that second chapter, he would point out to them that God will render to every man according to his deeds. It doesn't matter whether you're a Jew or whether you're a Gentile. He says in verse 12, "For as many as have sinned outside of the law shall perish outside of the law, and as many as have sinned in law shall be judged by law." So there is to be no difference between the Jew and the Gentile. That brought us then to our last class, which really continued and concluded the argument of the Jew. And so as our resume has told us, and we needn't go through this in any great detail then, when we came to the end of chapter 2, God was saying, through the Apostle Paul, what I'm concerned with is one who is a Jew inwardly, whose circumcision is of the heart, not just merely in the flesh. To which the Jew then concluded, well, if you're telling me that a believing Gentile is better than an unbelieving Jew, and he found that hard to accept, then what advantage is there in being a Jew? And so there were those series of four questions and answers. Question, answer, question, answer, question, what's the place for question, answer? Question, answer, question, answer, question, answer, question, answer. That's right. And he convinced them that there were many advantages in being a Jew. However, he could say then in Romans chapter 3, verse 9, what then? Are we better than they? No, in no wise. For we have before proved, both Jews and Gentiles, that they are all under sin. As it is written, there is none righteous, no, not one. And so what we have done then is we've come to the end of a section in which Paul has proved quite conclusively, it's not the one we want, it's the other one, the second half, there we are, but there, yeah. We've come to the conclusion then, down here, by the time we've got to chapter 3 and verse 20, that man left to himself has utterly failed to attain to righteousness. Now, in the latter part of that section, particularly, say, verses 19 and 20, Paul introduces what is going to become now a very important part of his reasoning. It was very clear, wasn't it, to see how in the latter part of chapter 1, the Gentiles had failed to attain to righteousness. That was very clear. It was very easy to see how in chapter 2, that if Jews were doing the same thing, they also had attained unto righteousness, had failed to attain unto righteousness. Therefore, God's wrath would be poured out upon Jew and Gentile alike. But as we get towards the end of that section, and if you're looking at an Oxford Bible, it's going to be a section of the book, something like this. He's quoted all of these passages of scripture down here, underlined in red, from verses 10 through to 18, to prove that all have sinned, there is none righteous, no, not one. But as we read verses 19 and 20 again, we see now that the law is being brought into focus. And so verse 19 says, "Now we know that whatsoever things the law saith, it saith to them who are under the law, that every mouth may be stopped and all the world may become guilty before God. Therefore, by works of law, there shall no flesh be justified in his sight, for by law is the knowledge of sin." Now, we must understand what he is saying in those two verses, because it's very important. It's easy to see how God's wrath is poured out upon people who are obviously unrighteous, like all those in chapter 1, or like the Jews in chapter 2. But what about the Jew who thought he was righteous because he was trying to keep the law? Paul's conclusion is that they are really in the same position. Their attitude to life may be a little bit different, but they were trying to obtain righteousness by keeping law. Now, the end result for those people is still going to be death. They may be living a more respectable way of life, as it would appear, to all outward intents and purposes. But you see, what the Apostle Paul concludes is, it's not just meaning the wicked Gentile who's failed to attain to righteousness, but it is anybody who is trying to attain to righteousness by any method other than God's method. And so he makes it very clear that you can't attain unto a righteousness which will lead to salvation by works of law. whether it be works of the law, in the sense of the law of Moses, or the works of any law. Let's just briefly ask why. I mean, he's going to spend several chapters developing this. Well, the answer is simply this. The moment that you say, well, I am doing a certain amount of work, you are making a bargain. You are making a deal. You are entering into a contract with somebody in which they then owe you a reward or a wage. And of course, as he points out here, all that the law ever did for those people was to tell them they were sinners. There was nothing in the law itself which could of itself give life. It was a wonderful schoolmaster, and Romans chapter 5 and chapter 7 in particular are going to tell us that it was the best possible law that man could ever get. It was holy, it was just, and it was good. But what was the purpose of the law? And as far as Paul is concerned in Romans, he sees one significant purpose. He says the significant purpose of the law of Moses was to tell you, you are a sinner. And therefore he can rightly conclude that section. He can rightly conclude that section by pointing out to these people that by works of law no flesh shall be justified. So the end result for that person would be just the same as the Gentile back in chapter 1. Because both of them were, in a sense, indulging in the flesh. You see, both Stoicism and Epicureanism are works of flesh. I quote those two because the Stoics and the Epicureans were the two philosophers that are referred to in Acts chapter 17, aren't they? The two branches of philosophy that Paul encountered. And in brief, the Stoic says, I abstain, and the Epicurean says, I indulge. But both of those are outworkings of the flesh. The indulging one is obvious. The abstaining one is really willpower, and willpower says, I have achieved a measure of righteousness by not doing certain things, and I've done it by my willpower. Well, willpower is only flesh. So whether it's that sort of flesh, which is a Judaism type of flesh, touch not, taste not, handle not, or in Gentile philosophy, Stoicism, it's still elevating the flesh. That's the very point Paul makes in Colossians 2. If you believe you've obtained righteousness by abstaining from the flesh, you're telling me you've done it by your willpower. Well, you may be leading a more respectable life than that Gentile out there who's utterly depraved, to use what Paul's words of Romans 1, but the end result is still the same. You can't attain to righteousness. And so that brings us then to where we are tonight, the beginning then of this next section, which is this section here, the righteousness of God revealed. Now, if we can just look at this, and you might just happen to notice that, and we'll just squeeze a little bit more up the top of the chart there, you notice how that this left-hand side of the insert, and you can see all of it on there, actually takes us down to the end of chapter 8. You might remember that I said a little earlier, we did 8 chapters of Romans in 8 studies. It actually is an important section in its own right, and the three sections are these. Here's Paul's argument. Once we've got through the introduction, and he tells us, I'm going to talk about the doctrine of the righteousness of faith, he said there's three ways which I'm going to develop my argument. I'm going to point out to you, first of all, that man has utterly failed to attain to righteousness. Whether it be the Gentiles of chapter 1, verses 18 to 32, whether it be the Jews of chapter 2, who have lived like the Gentiles, or whether it be even Jews under the law who have tried to obtain salvation simply by works of law. You have failed, 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 he says. Well, what are we going to do about it? Well, says the Apostle Paul, God has revealed his righteousness in his Son. And we're therefore going to, God willing, over the following classes, consider from chapter 3, verse 21, where we start tonight, through to chapter 5, verse 21, which will show to us the way in which God's righteousness has been revealed in his Son. A righteousness which can save. A righteousness which is apart from law. And it's generally considered that the first and the last components of that section, that is Romans chapter 3, verses 21 to 31, and Romans chapter 5, verses 12 to 21, are the two most significant sections of Scripture in relation to what we call the doctrine of the atonement. The atonement is simply the way in which the righteousness of God has been revealed in Jesus Christ. So tonight we are going to be considering the first of those two sections. So here's the pattern that we're following. Man has failed to attain to righteousness. We've taken 6 months to prove that, because that's how long it's taken us to get here. We are now going to consider the way in which God's righteousness unto salvation has been revealed, and then we come to the very exhortational section, which is chapters 6, 7 and 8, which we've entitled The Righteousness of God in Relation to the Believer's Life of Holiness. What does that mean then, as far as you and I are concerned? And I think by this stage some of you are starting to say, well, that sounds a bit frightening to me. We've just been told that mankind at large has totally failed. We're now going to look at the righteousness of God in Jesus Christ, the epitome of righteousness. I think I'll just pack up and leave it, because how am I going to fit into this category down here? How am I ever going to live up to those things? And really, when we come to those chapters, they are absolutely beautiful. You just take, for example, in anticipation of what's going to come when we get to chapter 7. When we get to chapter 7, the Apostle Paul concludes this. He says, with the mind, I myself serve the law of God, but with the flesh, the law of sin. He says, I find a war therefore going on in my members. And we say, oh yeah, that's right, that's the problem I've got. Paul says, that's good. He says, that's excellent, you've got a war going on. Well, why is he so pleased about it? Well, for the simple reason that if there's anybody in this hall tonight hasn't got a war going on in their members, then they've got a real problem. Because they've come to that conclusion from one or other of two reasons. Either they have totally disregarded the truth, and no longer have they got a conscience, and no longer are they the slightest bit interested in it. And I don't think that would apply to anyone, because you wouldn't be wasting your time coming here, if we use the word waste in that sense. So that would be one sense in which there's no war. The Gentiles who God had given up, they didn't have a war going on in their members. There was no law of their mind fighting against the law of their flesh. The other one might be who says, well, I don't find much of a fight going on. I don't think I'm doing too badly. Well, that is a problem. John deals with that in his epistle, and not quite so much Paul. Well, that means we're self-deceived. That means we fail to recognise what sin really is. And tonight in our study, we're going to come across the Bible definition of sin. So, there's your choice. Either you've got no war going on because you're like the Gentiles, you've just become totally depraved, and I think most of us can feel reasonably comfortable about that one. The other end is that we're just going so well that we don't have much of a fight. Then I submit that we may have lost sight of what sin is all about. That sin is not just the going around doing dreadful things, but sin is anything that falls short of the total manifestation of God. Well, where does that leave the rest of us? We've got a fight going on. Paul says that's excellent. Because whilst that fight's going on, you've got a law in your mind which is fighting against the law of your flesh. There is therefore now no condemnation to those people. That's where he goes. He says that at the end of chapter 7, and when he starts chapter 8, he says, there is therefore now no condemnation to those who are in Christ Jesus, who walk not after the flesh, but after the Spirit. And when he says walk not after the flesh, he means that with the mind they're walking after the Spirit, even though their flesh is totally at war, completely, continually at war with the mind. He says, of course it will be. If you haven't got that war, then you're telling God that he's a liar. Paul doesn't say that, but John does in his epistle. Because what you're saying is, I don't need Jesus Christ. The very fact that we need Jesus Christ is because we can't totally conquer the flesh like he did. Therefore, there's a war going on. And therefore, brethren and sisters, without suggesting we become complacent, we should be happy that the war is going on. Because that means that as long as the war is going on, we are not going to experience the wrath of God in the day of judgment. And that's the assurance that Paul gives us. And therefore, we needn't fear about considering chapters 6 and 8, 6 to 8. They are extremely encouraging chapters. And whilst the language is the typical language of Romans, which by the time we get there we'll be rather familiar with it, it's very encouraging indeed. But at the centre of all this is Jesus Christ. He's not just merely set up there as an example. That's one thing which he is there, and we aim for that example. But he has been set forth because we can't do it ourselves. We can't do it ourselves. But he is interested in helping us in the fight. Very interested in helping us. So we come then to where our class starts tonight. Romans chapter 3, the righteousness of God revealed, and we're going to look at verses 21 to 31 of the chapter. You know, having spent all of that time reviewing it, it does mean that by the time we come to the verses, we don't have to keep going down in deeply. I don't intend to try to make this an exhaustive or an exhausting study of Romans. But I believe that we can pick up the argument very easily. All right, well, we've got our notes there. The actual section where it starts was just on the bottom of page 21, which was the sheet that you got last week. If you haven't brought that with you or if you didn't get one, don't worry unduly. It just simply tells us that the title then of this section is The Righteousness of God Revealed, as you can see on the chart there. Chapter 3, verses 21. Chapter 3, verse 21 to chapter 5, verse 21. And that we're now going to be looking at this first part of that section, which is God's righteousness exhibited in Christ Jesus, which is Romans 3, verses 21 to 31. Let's pick it up then from verse 21. If you're following the notes as I go through them, you'll notice that I have on occasions put in other translations. NIV seems to invariably appear, the Authorised Version appears, the Revised Version appears, and the Dialog appears. I have on occasions... translation of some parts of Romans depend very much, but they often appear... No, let's start that sentence again. The way in which a person translates Romans is very often dependent upon their view of the doctrine. And when you get to this section on the atonement, you've got to be very careful of translators because they just have that little bit of a desire to throw in the doctrine of substitution or something like that. And that's why I haven't personally found any one translation perfect all the way through. If it comes to putting awkward sentences together and getting the idiom better, then I've found the NIV very, very helpful. If it comes to getting the specific meaning of a verse right, even though it may not be easy to read in English, then very often the Dialog is the best one. And somewhere down the middle, the Revised Version is traditionally regarded as perhaps the most conservative of all. So that's why I've jumped around with varying translations. Nevertheless, the NIV tends to predominate because reading these verses here, and I must confess that over the years I've often quoted from Romans chapter 3, verses somewhere in between verses 21 and 31, and I want to talk about the way in which the righteousness of God's been revealed. And I think, now what verse should we start at? And I usually start at verse 23. But when you look at it, verse 23 is halfway through a sentence. So how do you read it? For all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. Now, should that be a full stop? Or if not, and it's a colon or semicolon or something like that, then the sentence goes on, being justified freely by his grace through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus, whom God has set forth to be a propitiation. But what's the sentence saying? You can pick up some doctrines out of it, but it isn't easy to read it in the Authorised Version. I do find that the NIV makes it a little easier to read. All right, let's pick up our point then. Verse 21, and if you happen to glance at the notes in conjunction with this, you'll notice I've got the NIV translation of verse 21, which reads, "But now a righteousness from God, apart from law, has been made known, to which the law and the prophets testify." So you can see what's happening now. This is the beginning of the new section. Man has failed to attain to righteousness. The concluding verses of that previous section pointed out that even trying to get righteousness by keeping law was impossible. So verse 21 then, commencing the new section, is obvious, set in contrast to verse 20, in which Paul stated that no one will be declared righteous by observing the law, rather through the law we become conscious of sin. He argues that since all that the law did was reveal our sin, the justification of God's providing, and remember the word justification and righteousness are the same words, it's just the grammatical form of them we have trouble with in English, the accounting righteous, if you like, or the justification of God's providing must be by some other way. It can't be by indulging in the flesh, it can't be by keeping law, it's got to be by some other way. This inability of the law to give eternal life is dealt with in more detail later in the epistle. But Paul maintains that even the law and the prophets themselves testify to the fact that God would manifest a righteousness unto salvation that would be apart from law. It probably doesn't hurt any of us to look at this chart once again. We've seen it some other time somewhere before, just to remind ourselves of where the law fits into God's purpose. This is a time chart which takes us from BC 4000, approximately the period of creation, half the time of Christ, which is AD, BC, naught, or whatever you'd like to call that year, up to the year 2000, when approximately, we believe, the millennium will start, through to the end of the millennium, which is AD 3000. So we've got a period of, say, 7,000 years. That 7,000 years contains three great promises, three great covenants. There's what we would call the Edenic Covenant, Genesis 3:15, the promise of salvation. And that won't see its total fulfillment until the end of the millennium, when sin and death are ultimately eradicated. The other covenant, which particularly concerns the Jewish people, and it's usually this one that is referred to in contrast to the Mosaic, is the Abrahamic Covenant. The Abrahamic Covenant, like the Edenic Covenant, is also involved in eternal principles. The Abrahamic Covenant promised the Redeemer. The Abrahamic Covenant promised life. It promised eternal inheritance of the land of promise. Consequently, the complete fulfillment of that will not come until millennial times. But then, some 430 years after the promise was made to Abraham, God found his children, the children of Israel, down in the land of Egypt. He had to bring them out of the land of Egypt. He had to organize them and discipline them and prepare them to go into the promised land. To do that, he had to give them a law. And there it is. It's the law of Moses. He made a covenant with them which was related to that law, the promise of which was length of days in the land. And that was the greatest promise that law could offer them. Live according to the law and you will live happily and for a length of days in the land. And that law came in 430 years after the Abrahamic covenant was given, and it ended somewhere around about AD 33 or AD 70. You know, that period, there was a sort of a progressive ending there. It was nailed to Christ's cross. The temple was destroyed, all of that period. So it was a law which had a period of time associated with it. And it was a law which was never intended to do anything more than be a schoolmaster to bring people to Christ. On the one hand, that was the positive thing. In other words, it's saying, you look outside of me. You look at this Abrahamic covenant. And the other thing I'm telling you is, you need to look at it because you're a sinner. You're a sinner. The law magnified sin. It introduced a new offering called a sin offering. There was no sin offering before the law. There was a burnt offering, a meal offering, a peace offering. All those voluntary offerings were there, but there was no sin offering before the law. The law introduced it to say you're a sinner. Now see the problem. Here are Jews then saying, if I keep this law, God's got to give me life. Well, the fact was, none of them ever kept it. And God says, look, I'm not giving life to anybody on the basis of keeping law. I want you to understand that my righteousness is going to be revealed in this Abrahamic seed, or in this seed of the woman. So see the position. Here were people then living under this. It was almost like as though you were living with blinkers on. Because the law was so detailed, you were concentrating on it so intently that you forgot to sort of look around and say, well, look, this is only just a small part of God's purpose. It's only a means to an end. Like coming to a meeting is only a means to an end. Being made known, to which the law and the prophets testify. So even this period here, when the law and the prophets prevailed, it was always saying, look, I'm telling you about this. There's a righteousness to come. And it was all the time pointing forward. Verses 22 to 24. This, and we're reading the NIV version of it, this righteousness from God comes through faith in Jesus Christ to all who believe. There is no difference, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God and are justified freely by his grace through the redemption that came by Christ Jesus. Now that verse isn't difficult for us because we know that. We've been baptized into it. It's very straightforward. The righteousness of God comes because he that believes has faith, of course, the same word in the Greek. He that believes and is baptized shall be saved. That's what it's telling us. our comment on it says that the righteousness which is now manifested is not one which man can establish for himself by the observance of law. It is not earned. It is by faith in Jesus Christ. Those who believe in Jesus Christ are justified. They're deemed righteous freely by God's grace. It's a gift which God has arranged in mercy, quite unmerited by man. Furthermore, there is no difference between Jew and Gentile in this matter, since Christ has united them both together in himself, as we're told in Ephesians 2, verses 13 to 15. The statement in verse 23 is an important one. In verse 23, we read that all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. All have sinned and come short of the glory of God. Now, I believe that this is effectively perhaps the best definition of sin which we come across in the Bible. It shows to us that anything which falls short of a total manifestation of the glory of God is sin. It's, of course, related to the Hebrew word chatter, which is the normal word translated sin, but which really means to miss the mark. I emphasise this point because if someone says to you, "Would you please give me a definition of sin?" very often the answer comes back, "Well, sin is the transgression of the law," or "transgression of law." And that's a quote which comes from the 1st of John chapter 3, verse 4. That is not a good answer. That is not a good answer. One, it is quoting the Epistle of John out of context, because John is only talking about a particular type of sin. In fact, you'll find that most other translations speak about that verse in this way, that the sin is lawlessness. John is talking about some people who are totally lawless. So there are two reasons why it's not good to quote the 1st of John chapter 3, verse 4 as a definition of sin. One, because the AB translation is a bad one. And two, because he is not talking about sin in the overall sense. He's talking about a particular type of sin in which a person is living according to the carnal mind. In other words, it's not a case like Paul, where the law of his mind is desiring to serve God, and he's fighting against the flesh, which is saying, "I want to serve self." No, it's a life which is living according to a carnal mind. And Romans 8, verse about 5 or 6 says, "The carnal mind is enmity against God. It is not subject to the law of God, neither indeed can it be. It is therefore lawless." So without starting to indulge in the study of the Epistle of John, I would like to suggest, brethren and sisters, that when you think about sin, think in terms of Romans chapter 3, verse 23, not so much the 1st of John chapter 3, verse 4. Our note simply says that in 1st of John 3, verse 4, the statement "sin is the transgression of the law" in the Authorised Version is sometimes used as a definition of sin. But the context and other translations of the verse show that it is inappropriate, in fact wrong, to use it as a blanket definition for all sin. So just having made that little aside, let's then realise that anything which falls short of the glory of God is sin. Can we then come back to the point that we made earlier about the person who may feel that there's not a fight going on inside of them? That person may think, "Well, I don't know what I've done particularly wrong today." Well, let's ask ourselves, what have we done that's been particularly right today? Have we taken absolutely every opportunity to show forth the glory of God? Have we hidden our light under a bushel? Because if we've hidden our light under a bushel, we've sinned. We may not have transgressed law, or the law, if that's the way we want to use the 1st of John 3, 4, and therefore say we haven't sinned. But if we've fallen short of the glory of God, and we all fall short of the glory of God, then we've sinned. Therefore, we are in need of some other means of righteousness other than law. And that's what Paul is now developing as he shows to us that this has come through Jesus Christ. You may have another paragraph, I think, in your notes. Have you, after that one I've just read, before we come to verse 25? Well, you can cross it out because it's a reprint of something that's earlier on in that paragraph. I've reprinted my page, so mine's updated. But that next paragraph is a repeat of something that was said earlier. And in fact, if you look up Brother Carter's book, you'll find that the sentence was taken straight out of there anyway. Right, verse 25. Verse 25 is an interesting verse. Some of us would know what it means, some of us wouldn't, and therefore it is worthy of a comment. Because he's going to show to us now the way in which Jesus Christ has been set forth to declare the righteousness of God in order that people might be saved. So verse 25 says, and this is the revised version translation in our notes, whom God set forth to be a propitiation through faith by his blood. There is a little bit of argumentation about how you actually should read that verse, and I rather favour the revised version. So does Brother Carter. And I noticed looking up Vine's expository dictionary of New Testament words, I looked up propitiation in there, and he quotes the RV as well. Not that I would quote Vine as an authority in terms of doctrine, but there is just a slight difference there in the way in which it's worded. The end result is much the same, but I think this way we can understand what it's saying. I think the other way is a little bit different. What is the other way? The other way says, whom God hath set forth to be a propitiation through faith in his blood. In other words, it's saying we've got to believe in his blood. What does believe in his blood mean? Well, I suppose we could sort of talk around it and say, well, we really believe that as a result of the shedding of his blood, we can have forgiveness of sins. Well, that would be all right. Perhaps that's what it is saying. The revised version, on the other hand, puts it this way, whom God set forth to be a propitiation through faith by his blood. In other words, God has set him forth to be a propitiation by his blood. Well, whichever way you look at it, we've got to have faith, and our faith has to be in that which God has accomplished through the shedding of the blood of the Lord Jesus Christ. So really, the end result is not going to differ. It's just a matter of how easy we find it to read it. And for myself, well, that would be all right. Perhaps that's what it is saying. The revised version, on the other hand, puts it this way, whom God set forth to be a propitiation through faith by his blood. In other words, God has set him forth to be a propitiation by his blood. Well, whichever way you look at it, we've got to have faith, and our faith has to be in that which God has accomplished through the shedding of the blood of the Lord Jesus Christ. So really, the end result is not going to differ. It's just a matter of how easy we find it to read it. And for myself, I find the RV puts it just that little bit easier. Whichever way you like to take it, however, the point of the next paragraph is important. If the preceding verses, and this isn't meant to be a question or a possibility, it's just an English way of putting it perhaps. If the preceding verses speak of what God has accomplished through his Son, verses 25 and 26 commence to explain how he has accomplished it. Right, see how the argument's developing then. The previous verse is saying God has accomplished certain things. He's declared his righteousness. Now the next few verses are going to tell us how he's done it. Well, he says he set him forth. He set him forth. The Greek word protithemi, something like that, really means to place before. Now, there's two ways you can interpret that. To place something before somebody either means you exhibit it, I place that before you, put it on top of the microphone. I won't really, but you can place it before someone, so you exhibit it. Or on the other hand, I can put some ideas before you. I can present some ideas. I want to put this idea before you. It's two different things. But the word protithemi can mean both of those. It can mean to exhibit or to propose or purpose, if you like. So it says God has set Jesus forth. Has he exhibited him or has he purposed to do something with him? And once again, the answer is both. Both apply. Jesus was openly presented or exhibited to the world as a meeting place between God and man. And we say here, in contrast to the tabernacle meeting place, in which entry was very restricted, and I say that deliberately because we're going to look at this word propitiation in just a moment and see how it takes up the idea of the tabernacle. In the tabernacle worship under the law, man couldn't get close to God. Only one man, on one day of the year, could ever get in close to God. And then it was only in a constitutional ceremonial way, and that was the high priest on the Day of Atonement, when the blood was sprinkled on the mercy seat. But God has set forth Jesus Christ. Galatians says he's placarded him. So it's not a hidden thing like under the law. It's openly displayed. On the other hand, if we take the word to mean to propose, to set forth as an idea or a purpose, well, taking up what Paul had said in verse 21, he says that the law and the prophets all reveal that God proposed or purposed that his own son would be the means of ultimately reconciling the world unto himself. Well, we don't need to make the verses any more difficult than they appear. All it's simply saying is here is this, that all mankind has fallen short of the glory of God. Now, what has God done about that? God has set forth his son, Jesus Christ, to be a propitiation. To be a propitiation. First of all, the word propitiation is a bad translation. I wonder just how many people really know what the word propitiation means in English anyway. It's a very old-fashioned English word. Actually, I looked it up in the dictionary tonight to find out what it did mean. And propitiation means the act of being propitious. So, having clarified that, we'll cease to deal too much with English. I forgot to look what propitious was. But, well, we'll get off that subject about the English meaning of the word. It's not an easy word to understand, is it, or know what it's trying to say. Some say, well, of course, what should be translated? It should be translated this way. Whom God hath set forth to be a propitiatory. In other words, it's not so much an adjective. What's propitiation? Yeah, no, it's not so much a noun, it's an adjective. And I didn't find that much more helpful either. Look, the word propitiation there only occurs twice in the New Testament. Here it's translated propitiation. In Hebrews 9 verse 5 it's translated as mercy seat. And that's what it's all about. That's why they're saying it should be translated as propitiatory, which means a propitiatory place. Actually, it's quite interesting to study what do we understand by the word mercy seat itself. Our note at the top of page 23 says that the word here rendered propitiation, and the Greek word is hilasterion, is better translated as mercy seat, and is so translated in Hebrews 9 verse 5. That's the other place where it occurs. Now, can we see the idea of the tabernacle? Let's put a picture of the tabernacle up. We've got one here somewhere. Yeah, that's one, but that's not the one that we really want. This one is the better one. Here is our tabernacle. The outer court, the holy place, the most holy place, and there in the most holy place is the ark, and the central feature of the ark was the mercy seat with the cherubim all part and parcel of that one golden plate overshadowing the mercy seat. There was the centermost point of Israel's whole existence. And one man out of one family, out of one tribe, on one day in the year, could come in there and sprinkle the blood of bulls and goats, which could never take away sin. So, there was the mercy seat, which was hidden from view. Paul says, God has set forth Jesus Christ. He's exhibited into the world. Everyone can see this mercy seat. Everyone can partake of this mercy seat. And so we ask, what do we really mean by mercy seat? Well, in the Hebrew language, the word is kafaret, which really means a covering. It wasn't just merely a covering to a box, because the ark was a box. Concordant translation translates as a copper, and the copper had a covering over it. Yes, it did cover the box, but the idea was it was to ceremonially represent the covering of sin. But as Paul pointed out in Hebrews, it could never take away sin. It was only a constitutional thing. But Jesus Christ now has been openly exhibited to the world as the true mercy seat. So what we're saying is that the word hilasterion, the word propitiation, really means mercy seat, and it's picking up the idea of the law, and I do believe this is exactly what Paul meant back in verse 21 when he says, but now a righteousness from God apart from law has been made known, to which the law and the prophets testify. So he says, if you understood what all this tabernacle was about, you'd know that that mercy seat was pointing forward to Jesus Christ. In this regard, the following comment from the Diaglot is relevant, and I've included there a comment from the Diaglot footnote found in Romans chapter 3 and verse 25, a footnote at that page. And the note says this: the word hilasterion never signifies propitiation, as it is translated in the common version, but it is always used, wherever it occurs, both in the Old Testament and the New, to express the mercy seat, which was the golden lid of the ark, upon which the Shekinah, or cloud of glory, rested, and from which oracles were dispensed. And then the note goes on to say, see Exodus 25, verse 22, Numbers, would you tell me what it says there, Numbers chapter 7, verses 3 and 9, right, and Leviticus chapter 17, verse 2, and Hebrews chapter 9, verse 5. Now that's exactly what the Diaglot says, but some of those quotes are wrong. So you might like to correct the quotes. The typing is right. It's an exact representation of what the Diaglot says, but two of those quotes are wrong. The one in Numbers should not be Numbers 7 verses 3 and 9. It should be Numbers 7 verse 89. I did have to check that there were 89 verses in the chapter. It seemed a lot, but it's the very last verse of Numbers 7. So verses 3:9 should be 89. You might say, why didn't I check them before? Well, the fact was I hadn't checked them until after the typing had gone for printing. And Leviticus should be Leviticus 16, verse 2. They have a habit of putting the chapters in Roman numerals, and the X's and the V's and the I's sometimes get a bit out of kilter, and they had it as 17. So Leviticus 16, verse 2, and they will be the correct references. We just really need to take Exodus 25 as the key to this. If we can just have a glance at Exodus 25, we have there an excellent definition of what the purpose of the mercy seat was under the law, and consequently then it would be exactly the same purpose in the Lord Jesus Christ, only of course in a greater sense. Exodus chapter 25... The details of the mercy seat really start in about verse 17. Thou shalt make a mercy seat of pure gold, etc., etc. We won't read all of the details at this stage. And when we come down to verse 22, we read, verse 21, and thou shalt put the mercy seat above upon the ark, and in the ark thou shalt put the testimony that I shall give thee, and there I will meet with thee. There's the expression, there I will meet with thee, and I will commune with thee from above the mercy seat, from between the two cherubim, which are upon the ark of the testimony of all things which I will give thee in commandment unto the children of Israel. Now, if we can just remember that simple expression, that as far as the mercy seat is concerned, it is there I will meet with thee. So the mercy seat then was to be the place where Yahweh says, I will meet with thee. By the way, the idea of a mercy seat probably came from the idea that in some of the references to the cherubim, it says that Yahweh sitteth between the cherubim. Well, yes, that's all right in respect to that particular comment, but really the word kaphoret doesn't have any idea of a seat at all. It really simply means a covering. But I don't want to get too involved in whether mercy seat is a good or a bad translation. Providing we know what it is and what it did, then we won't worry too much at this stage about the translation in the Old Testament. Having some more trouble with the notes, are we? Some people got... There's two pages. Who didn't get two pages? And who still wants two pages? All right. should be 22 and 23. Okay, 22 and 23, and we were just finishing the note on verse 22. Well, from that reference in Exodus then, we can see that the purpose of the mercy seat was that there God would meet with Israel. The particular way in which he met with them was that on the Day of Atonement, the high priest went into the holy place and into the most holy place, and the incense from the altar of incense covered the mercy seat, that he die not, and there was the sprinkled blood. So the incense representing the prayer and the blood that was sprinkled there allowed Israel to once again ceremonially have their sins covered in a national constitutional sense. It didn't give them a hope of eternal life, but it taught them a certain principle. Now the mercy seat was the focal point of all of that activity. Well, says Paul in Romans chapter 3, if you want to know what God has done in Jesus Christ, he has exhibited him to the world, he has set him forth, he's purposed that he is the one where, says God, I will meet with you. But how did God meet with man? Under the law, it could only be through the sprinkled blood. And therefore, if Jesus Christ was to be a mercy seat, there had to be blood associated with it. And consequently, then, not only is he the mercy seat, but it is also his blood that was to be sprinkled on it. And those who've studied Hebrews will recall that Jesus, of course, fulfilled all of these. He was the true tabernacle. He was the sacrifice. He was the priest. He was everything. Now, in the context of Romans, Jesus Christ now is this mercy seat. Taking up then verses 25 and 26, reading it from the NIV, it reads, he did this to demonstrate his justice or righteousness, because in his forbearance he had left the sins committed beforehand unpunished. He did it to demonstrate his justice, his righteousness, at the present time, so as to be just and the one who justifies those who have faith in Jesus. I thought John Carter's comment was very good. He says God has set forth Jesus and he has done it to declare his righteousness. Why was this necessary? Because of the passing over of sins done aforetime in the forbearance of God. For 4,000 years, God had passed over sins. He points out that the word passed over there is a different word from the one usually translated, remission, as in the RV and AV margin. Well, he says, did then God lightly esteem sin? And the answer is no. He forbore for a time in view of this exhibition of his righteousness. You know, it's just another way of saying that all of those people who lived for the previous 4,000 years, what did God do with their sins? Did he treat them lightly? No, God forbore with them. You know, the forbearance of God is a very, very important word. The forbearance of God, it's the fact that God is long-suffering. Peter says God's long-suffering is our salvation. Why didn't he kill everybody permanently who died prior to the coming of Christ? Because God's righteousness had not yet been revealed. But he says it is now revealed. So let's read those verses again and see what they say. He did this to demonstrate his justice, because in his forbearance he had left the sins committed beforehand unpunished. So he hadn't punished people for sins committed back here, providing the people living back here had looked forward in faith to this declaration of righteousness, which is now, says Paul, revealed. So the people prior to Christ, as we well know, had to see Christ typified in the law. They had to see him as the seed of Abraham, the seed of the woman, and so forth. So you see, faith was just as effective back in this 4,000 year period as it has ever been since. Even more so because Christ hadn't been exhibited. We hardly have to exhibit faith today. It's just a matter of knowledge. But these people had to believe that all of the animal sacrifices he appointed forward. And so God forbore with them in view of the fact that one day he was going to exhibit a mercy seat that everybody could see. In the meantime, he hid it away here in a tabernacle. He showed it in shadow and in type. And so he did it to demonstrate his justice at the present time. The present time when Paul wrote. That he might be just and the one who justifies those who have faith in Jesus. Now, says Paul, everything that God has done has been perfectly righteous. He didn't kill these people back here because many of them in faith look forward to this one to come. Abraham saw my day. He saw it and was glad. He saw the day of the manifestation of Jesus Christ to declare the righteousness of God. I believe he saw the day of his coming glory as well. But Abraham lived by faith. And that's what Paul's going to talk about, God willing, next class when we come to Romans 4. He believed that the seed would come. Now, says Paul, we see it. God, therefore, is perfectly just in what he has done in Jesus Christ, and he has done it to demonstrate that he alone is righteous. Taking up our note from where we left it off, we'd read the point, did God then lightly esteem sin? The answer is no. He forbore for a time in view of this exhibition of his righteousness. He foreordained this work, that, and taking a quote from Hebrews, a death having taken place for the redemption of, he foreordained this work, that a death having taken place for the redemption of the transgressions that were under the first covenant, they that have been called may receive the promise of the eternal inheritance. And so God had foreordained from the beginning of time that he would set forth his Son. And here now, says Paul, we've seen God's righteousness exhibited. Why then go back to the law? Why do you want to go back to this sort of thing? Why are you trying to obtain salvation by this? Because everybody living back here who lived by faith in the Edenic or Abrahamic covenant. And they're all looking to the righteousness of God being revealed. But there were other people who also lived during this period, but instead of living under these blue things, they only lived under the red. Oh yes, many people who were living under the red also lived under the blue. It's a sort of a thing which simply means that if you were a Jew, you found that your day-to-day existence was governed by the law, this red line here. But that didn't mean that you had to live by law, you could still live by faith. And so living by faith, they looked forward to it, and they knew that one day God's righteousness would be revealed in a true mercy seat that everybody could have access to, whether Jew or Gentile, for, says Paul, there is no difference. Well, that brings us then to the concluding verses 27 to 31, which we're going to conclude fairly quickly because the theme has to do with boasting. And I don't want to say too much about this. We're going to comment more on that, all being well, when we come particularly to chapter 5. We'll take up the theme of boasting a little bit more then, because there is such a thing as good boasting. Not perhaps in the sense of the English word, but certainly the Greek word. Let's take verses 27 to 31. Where then is boasting? Because the Jew had been boasting in the law. I am a Jew. I am circumcised. It is excluded. No man can boast. On what principle is it excluded? On that of observing the law? No. But on that of faith. For we maintain that a man is justified by faith apart from observing the law. Stop there for a moment. Here were people that were living during the period of the law, but if they were prepared to see in the Abrahamic covenant the righteousness of God revealed in this man, then they were living by faith. So a person like Moses could live under the law and yet live by faith. Abraham could live before the law and live by faith. So the law was but a schoolmaster. Don't then think that you're going to get salvation by that law. You'll find yourself in the same position as those Gentiles who will die outside of law. So those who sin outside of law perish. Those who sin inside of law, they will be judged. So the quote goes on to say, Is God the God of Jews only? Is he not the God of Gentiles too? Yes, of Gentiles too. Since there is only one God who will justify the circumcision by faith and the uncircumcised through that same faith. Do we then nullify the law by this faith? Not at all. Rather, we uphold the law. And we're not going to develop that point tonight, but I think perhaps even most of us can see already what he's saying. They're saying to Paul, "Paul, you're telling us then that we should be living like these blue lights. In other words, then, the law was useless." "Oh no," says Paul. "We are actually upholding that law. But we're upholding it as a law. We're not upholding it as a way of righteousness under salvation. It was a law. And Romans says it was holy, it was just, and it was good. We're going to go out here tonight and there are going to be laws of the land that we have to abide by when we drive home. Those laws are for our good. They don't mean we're not going to have an accident, but they are for our good. God's law, the law of Moses, was the best possible law that could ever be given. And a similar law, we believe, will be reintroduced in the kingdom age for the mortal nations. He will magnify the law, he will make it honourable. They'll be brought under a similar dispensation because look at that world out there. How are you going to convert them to Christ? Well, many of them will never be converted to Christ. They'll be like the generation that had to die in the wilderness. But a new generation coming up will need to be disciplined. But once again, even in the kingdom, they'll have to manifest faith in this same covenant, which is still going through. The seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent will still be in conflict right from the end of the millennium amongst the mortal nations. And there'll be another one of these red lines. We might even draw a red line in there and say there's going to be a law in there. It won't save them, but it will educate them. So, says Paul, people who live by faith are upholding that law, but they're upholding it as a law. They are not upholding it as a way of righteousness which will give them life because they've kept that law. Just a few then comments on the bottom of the page there on one or two of the expressions. Where is boasting then? Well, boasting signifies glorying, and this of course is to be excluded. The question comes, by what law? Well, it literally means by what kind of law. That is, law in the sense of principle of operation. Of works? Well, of course not of works, because works encourages boasting. The moment you start tallying up all the works you've done, there's that desire there to start thinking that we're a little bit better than what we are. Not of works, faith. This expresses our dependence on God and thereby excludes boasting. So we're beginning to see now how when God has set forth Jesus Christ, he's placarded him, he's exhibited him, we must have faith in his blood. This is expressing to God our dependence on God. And that's going to come out very powerfully. And I think of the 8 studies I did in Christchurch, if a vote was taken as to which was the most powerfully exhortational one, it would be, I think, the opening verses of chapter 4, in which Abraham and David are taken as examples of men who had righteousness imputed unto them because of their faith in God, not because of their works. And so in verse 29, Paul argues that you either conceive what I'm saying or you say that God's authority extends to the Jew alone. In verse 30, he argues that the very basis of Jewish religion is the belief in one God. He will justify the circumcision out of faith, and the uncircumcision die through the faith. Brother Thomas has a very good comment in the Mystery of the Covenant of the Holy Land Explained, in which he points out that the Jew simply had to manifest faith in that covenant that was already given to his fathers. A Jew was born into this Abrahamic stock. All he had to do was to believe it. But what about the Gentiles who are somewhere out here? They first of all got to accept that faith and then have faith in that faith. So you see, there is a difference. And literally it would read like this: he will justify the circumcision, that is the Jews, as a result of faith, but the uncircumcision, that is the Gentiles, will be justified through the faith. And that word "the" should be there in the Greek. So there is a difference. The Jew is justified by faith. The Gentile has to be justified through faith in the faith. That is the faith that was given to Israel. So faith then places law on its proper footing and establishes its authority. Thus, Gentiles who have not law, through faith, perform the works of the law. For though faith might bring liberty from sin, it never creates license to sin. powerful point which is not being made so much at the moment, but will certainly come later on. But see then how, you know, we might have thought that last verse was difficult. Do we then make void the law through faith? And you might say, well, the answer is yes, of course we do. Faith has replaced law. But Paul doesn't argue it that way. He says, no, no, let it not be. We've actually established the law. But you see the argument he's making. He says, our faith doesn't nullify the law. There's nothing wrong with the law. It's just what you're trying to take out of the law. And if you're trying to take too much out of that law, then of course you're trying to make the law do something that it was never intended to do. So our faith does not nullify the law. At no stage does the Apostle Paul ever say anything bad about the law. It may say that the law kept telling me that I'm a sinner. He may say that the more that the law reminded him that he was a sinner, the more he wanted to sin, because he said, when the law says thou shalt not covet, that brought out a desire in me to covet. But that didn't make the law bad. Nothing wrong with the law. So a person who lives by faith, in fact, establishes God's law. Because he says there are Gentiles who are living by faith. And when you look at the way of their way of life, you'd say, but they're living according to law. They're not really living according to law, but they're doing all the things that a person who lived under that law would be seen to be doing. That sort of makes sense. They're not living because there is a law which says live that way. They believe in God, they have faith in those principles, and when you look at their way of life, they're doing things that the Jew, who should have been living according to those things, wasn't doing. So the Gentile who lives by faith establishes law. He does not in any way nullify it. Well, that's brought us then to the end of that particular chapter. We picked up the wrong one again. It's this one. That's brought us then to the end of that chapter. God's righteousness exhibited in Christ Jesus. It will be our intention, God willing, and I believe it's next Wednesday night. We've got 2 weeks straight, I think. When we're going to be looking at the example of Abraham, really this should be Abraham and David. And in many ways, I think the example of David is the one that perhaps it comes across to us more powerfully. On that occasion, it is our intention to have a look at Psalms 51 and 32. 51 because it was alluded to back in chapter 3 and verse 4, and we said we'll reserve consideration of it a little later. And Psalm 32 because it's linked with that psalm and is actually quoted in Romans chapter 4. So then we have begun to look at that section in which we see that it was vitally important that God's righteousness had to be revealed in some other way than law. It's now being revealed in his Son. And bit by bit, Paul is going to show to us how we can identify with that, and then ultimately what that means as far as our own personal way of life is concerned.